Your support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you visited the St. Louis Rams website on the weekend of Super Bowl 36, perhaps you noticed a map outlining the official St. Louis Rams victory parade route and a list of the details of the team's inevitable championship rally. But it was the New England Patriots who enjoyed the parade, and ever since February the 3rd, Rams fans have been trying to figure out what went wrong. Now, fan angst has intensified. The Rams lost their first two games of the new NFL season. Joining me now on the line is St. Louis Post-Dispatch columnist Brian Burwell. And Brian, what have fans and observers been saying about the Rams' mysterious inability to win?
Well, most of the fans have been looking for a bridge or a very tall building to jump off of. And clearly, there's nobody left on the bandwagon but the Rams. It's not like they're the Detroit Lions. I mean, when you talk about 0-2 in Detroit, you're talking about absolutely no hope, no chance. We're talking snowball's chance in hell of digging yourselves out of that. But the Rams, my God, they were in the Super Bowl two of the last 3 years. Their 0-2 is a little bit different. They can dig out of this.
Well, I've been looking at the chat rooms regarding the Rams, and among the explanations I've seen, some feel the refs have it in for the Rams. Some want head coach Mike Martz to assume what's been called his abrasive former persona. One fan even suggested the Rams should have atoned for their sins on Yom Kippur. Have any of these folks got it right?
They're funny, and I really enjoy fans because they have a great passion for the game. But that passion is sometimes, it obscures reality. You know, it's been funny, though. Actually, this whole notion of being glad that Mike Martz has re-embraced his abrasive persona is, I got to be honest with you, after they lost in Denver, Mike came out at the post-game press conference, and we thought it was the Stepford coach. He was so, you had to see him. It was weird. He had this smile on his face, sort of like your child does when you've caught them red-handed and they're going, "Mommy, Daddy, hi, I love you." And that was what we got out of Mike. He was like, "Any questions?" You know, like, I'm like, "Who is this?" We all looked at each other like, did they bring a pod in? And you know, it was Attack of the Body Snatchers, and we got some, this isn't Mike. But boy, we felt real good when we saw him this week, and he was cracking on a Tampa Bay reporter who asked him it was a very harmless question. He just asked him, he says, "You know, in the past, Tampa Bay has had some success stopping you guys." "Oh, really? You think so? How about 2 years ago? You remember that? Well, what was the score then, huh? What was the score?"
Well, now you bring up Tampa Bay. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers are a pretty good club. That's the team that the Rams have to play next in game number 3. No team has ever won the Super Bowl after losing their first 3 games. Is there a concern here?
Oh, there's no question there's a concern. And I think there is such a sense of urgency on the Rams now. These guys, I think to a great extent, they are like a lot of other championship teams, regardless of the sport. When you have been to the championship game more than one time in a short period of time, there's a sense that, you know what, guys, we know exactly what has to be done, and the regular season often becomes mundane. I suspect that they will have an entirely different sense of urgency on Monday night against Tampa, and they have no choice. They have to win.
Before the season began, the Rams had been chosen by just about everybody to win the next Super Bowl, while the Patriots were chosen for 5th or 6th at best on a lot of lists. Do folks in St. Louis find it odd that this week it's the Patriots who are 2-0, the Rams that are 0-2, or are people starting to think that maybe the Rams were just overrated?
Well, you know, I'm sure that's what a lot of fans are thinking. But, you know, that's okay. You know, fans get overly passionate about things. This is a good football team. Their timing has been off on offense because they did not have the full cast of characters together during the preseason. There were some injuries, and Mike Martz was trying to protect his starters and his star players. Defensively, they've made some mistakes. The sort of defense they play, there's a premium that is placed on tackling, which seems a little funny when you think about
that. A bit basic.
Playing football, and a premium is being paid on tackling, and they haven't been doing that. We were joking about it. When you watch game film of last Sunday's game, you realize that the DBs were twisted and turned so many different ways by the giant wide receivers that you figured they had to order a chiropractor to come in and fix these guys' backs.
Well, short of a chiropractor and maybe some of the guys who haven't been entirely healthy getting healthy, what else do the Rams have to do to turn it around?
Fundamentals. Go back to basics. You know, defensively, I was talking to Don Davis, one of the linebackers, and he said, you know, because we instituted this new defense last year and it worked so well, there was almost this feeling when the season started this year that, you know what, everybody knows this thing. We've got it down cold. Well, guess what? He said, we didn't have it down cold. There's some new people here, and they don't know the defense as well as we thought they did. He said, so we've got to go back to some basics and really stress fundamentals. And offensively, just two things, execution and give the ball to Marshall Faulk. He's the deadliest man on the planet. Put the ball in his hands and let him win the ball game.
Brian Burwell covers pro football as well as other matters for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He was kind enough to pull off the highway for a moment and speak with me. Brian, thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime I can uplift my credibility by appearing on NPR, it's always a pleasure.
For the first time since the mid-90s, fans of the Dallas Cowboys entered September hopeful. The Cowboys had enjoyed a good draft and made some useful trades. Second-year quarterback Quincy Carter looked sharp in the preseason, and perhaps best of all, the Cowboys had a gimme in their opening game. Surely Dallas would easily brush aside the expansion Houston Texans. And then, as Glenn Mitchell of member station KERA in Dallas reports, the darndest thing happened to the Cowboys.
They lost. The Cowboys were beaten 19-10 by a patchwork offense and rookie quarterback David Carr. The Cowboys' young quarterback, Quincy Carter, looked terrible. There was no running game, and the defense was clueless. Dallas fans, sports reporters, and talk show hosts all described the loss in apocalyptic language, the most embarrassing loss in the team's 43-year history.
In our town.
And lots of Cowboys-Texans talk this morning. The Cowboys losing to the expansion Texans last night, 19-10.
Uh-oh.
That was a train wreck yesterday.
I talked all week about how this was a dangerous game for the Cowboys, and nobody would drink that Kool-Aid with me.
They're flirting with a winless September now.
The Cowboys open the whole
last Sunday, they faced another team from Houston, the Tennessee Titans. Pro Bowl quarterback Steve McNair and running back Eddie George had just beaten a highly regarded Eagles team. But Dallas played almost flawless football and won. Welcome to the NFL. Wide receiver Joey Galloway.
Well, I think we were very disappointed in the way we played last week. You know, disappointed in the mistakes we made. Came in this week and refocused and tried to take care of those mistakes and eliminate them. We went out against a very tough team. Not many people gave us a chance except ourselves. And, you know, actually went out there and executed. And that shows if you execute, then you can beat anybody in this league.
And Dallas fans were convinced they had seen the real Cowboys, not the doppelgangers humiliated the previous week in Houston.
This week is the one we expected to see because they can actually play football this week. Last week they lost to an expansion team. They were horrible last week. Quincy Carter played great this week. Emmitt played better. Offensive line played good.
Quincy Carter passing the ball downfield made the difference in the game. We ran the ball well,
But Quincy Carter passing the ball consistently won us the game.
Number one, baby, Super Bowl 2002.
Well, why not? New England won last year's Super Bowl after a 5-11 season in 2000. They did it without a star quarterback and with a solid defense, Dallas's strength, at least for now. And head coach Dave Campo says there's nowhere for Carter to go but up.
I thought Quincy did some good things. He still has to grow. There's some things that he does that he needs to get better at, and that's why he's only a 10th start. He's going to get better as the year goes on. We've just got to hang in there and keep competing and give our team a chance to get better from week to week.
Asked about Carter, running back Emmett Smith, who sometime this year will surpass Walter Payton's career rushing record, also stuck up for the second-year quarterback. But he could have been defending any players on the NFL yo-yo.
I think everybody out there want to do good and try to do good every week. Some weeks just don't work out that way. And when it don't, people on your back, regardless of who you are. They're on your back. And when it's good, everybody want to look for reasons why to praise you. So, I mean, when you got a wishy-washy situation like that, you know what you have to do? You got to be confident in yourself, and you got to be grounded. And when you're grounded, you can shuck some of this stuff off and just keep moving forward and try to get better every week. And I think that's what he's trying to do.
At least the Cowboys can laugh at themselves, after a win anyway. Offensive coordinator Bruce Coslett responded to a comment that Quincy Carter had actually thanked reporters for their criticism after the Houston game.
Well, see, I mean, that's a young quarterback that doesn't know what the hell he's doing. Thanking the media? Yeah. I'll talk to him about that.
Do you want
to never thank,
on?
Never, no, never thank the media. No, I'm kidding. You guys are thinner skinned than we are.
We'll see who laughs next. Dallas has lost 5 of their last 6 regular season games against Philadelphia. That's where they're headed tomorrow. For Only a Game, I'm Glenn Mitchell in Dallas.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Many sports involve risk. Ask anybody who's ever heard a fastball sizzle by his ear or had his spleen rearranged by the business end of a hockey stick. Still, Jamie Ansco, who plays rugby for the Wigan Warriors in Great Britain's Tetley's Super Rugby League, got more than he bargained for when he discovered the tooth of one Martin Gleeson in his arm. Ansco had tackled Gleeson, who plays for the St. Helens Saints, in a game a month previous to the grisly discovery. Eventually, the swelling of Ainsco's arm led to the emergence of Gleason's tooth, and Ainsco will now need surgery for a bone infection, a condition serious enough so that he's out for the season, not to mention appalled.
Because I've got you,
got you,
baby, I've
got you,
baby, I've
got you,
under my skin.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The CIA says it had information about 3 of the September 11th hijackers at least 20 months before the attacks occurred, but failed to pass the information on to other agencies. You can read more about the story at WBUR.org. Just click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Coco Budakian and Sons, named Oriental Rug Retailer of the Year by the Atlanta International Rug Market for their commitment to consumer education. In Winchester and at KOKORugs.com. Nixon Peabody LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses with offices in the East and in California, but on the web at NixonPeabody.com. And Tufts Health Plan, offering comprehensive health coverage with a range of product and benefit options to employers in Massachusetts. Details at TuftsHealthPlan.com. Partly sunny skies today, highs near 80, in Boston now at 66 degrees, at 720 here at WBUR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Iron Kids Rule. But first, part of pro sports is promotion, and lots of promotion is pretty weird. The Dynamite Lady, who used to blow herself up at home plate before minor league baseball games, comes to mind. But sometimes an organization will come up with a promotional event that gets it just right. Last weekend, the Boston Breakers staged an exhibition game against the Washington Freedom, a humble enough undertaking, except that the Breakers invited Michelle Akers to suit up for the home team and turned the evening into a celebration of her exceptional career. Thus, before a sellout crowd at Nickerson Field in Boston, the greatest player in the history of the women's game played once more. Following a practice the day before the game, Akers was cautiously optimistic about the affair.
Well, it's great. It's just, I was smiling the whole time out there. It's fun. It's just fun to be back out there and playing and kind of in the rhythm of, you know, a life I led, you know, my whole life.
Michelle Akers, who is 36, made her first appearance with the U.S. national team in 1985. She led the team to victory in the first ever Women's World Cup in China 6 years later. By the time she'd concluded her career with another World Cup victory in 1999, she had also scored 136 goals in 153 international matches, won an Olympic gold medal, and been named U.S. Soccer's Female Athlete of the Year twice, as well as the most valuable player in the World Cup tournament once. After her retirement, FIFA, soccer's world governing body, named Michelle Akers co-player of the century. Among the players given the happy opportunity to play alongside Michelle Akers in Saturday's exhibition was 24-year-old Breakers forward Sarah Yohe, who had actually encountered the future co-player of the century some 14 or 16 years earlier.
She was playing at University of Central Florida, which is where I'm from in Orlando. And she just used to come out to our club team and help our team. And at the time, we were like, oh, you know, like, it's this girl that plays, you know, in college. Like, she's so good. And then a couple of years go by and she goes on and you find out that she's this, you know, world-class player. And it's just awesome to know that someone like that can come out and just help everyday kids who are trying to get better.
For Sarah Yohe, the opportunity to play in front of Michelle Akers and receive her passes was more than a fantasy come true.
It's a great honor. I mean, not too many people can say that they've played with Michelle Akers, and I mean, she's one of the best soccer players for women's soccer that there's ever been. So just to be able to play on the same team as her was an honor.
Alas, the honor was a one-shot deal. When she retired, Akers needed surgery on her knee and her face, and her shoulder was so badly damaged that she couldn't reach the coffee mugs in her kitchen cabinet. These circumstances made it clear what Akers would be doing with at least a portion of her retirement, but they didn't limit her for long.
Well, I've been putting my body back together since I retired from the national team in 99. That's been primarily my number one focus. And then after that, it's been doing some camps and clinics and working on being a cowgirl. I have a couple horses, and then I went to EMT school, and I'm considering going to be a paramedic, but I have to see how my body turns out first.
Despite the doubt evident in that assessment, Michelle Akers practiced and played well enough to have Breakers general manager Joe Cummings smiling over how scary some WUSA team might have looked with Michelle in the middle, and shaking his head about the injuries that had made it impossible for Akers to join the league. Some of those injuries came as a direct consequence of the way Akers played the game. Beyond the continuous repairs to her shoulders and various other joints, Michelle Akers, notorious for the way she threw her body around and intimidated opposing players with her size and her determination to seize control of play at the midfield, took a fair amount of punishment about the head. When I reminded her that we'd first met after a game in Florida some years ago, she nodded and said, "Yeah, that would have been a few concussions back." As if all that hasn't been more than enough, Akers has also battled chronic fatigue syndrome for years. She assumes that fight will be ongoing.
Still, you know, work in progress, always looking to feel better and to find something that will help me feel better and get better over the years. But, you know, compared to 2 years ago, I'm, 50% better, and I expect 2 years from now I'll be feeling even better than that.
That struggle and seven surgeries over the past 2 years have not kept Michelle Akers from active involvement with Soccer Outreach International, a faith-based organization which she began in order to run soccer clinics and integrate life and leadership skills into the daily routines of children.
We just reach the kids through soccer, so that's kind of the door. I mean, if anybody, as far as was trying to reach me when I was growing up, it would have been on the soccer field because, I love the game. So that's kind of the opportunity we've taken with the kids is to use the game to teach them soccer, but more importantly, talk to them about their lives and what's most important and try to help them focus on who they are and how they can serve their community.
Saturday's event was remarkable not only in that Michelle Akers could play, but because it gave more than 10,000 fans the opportunity to see, either once more or for the first time, the player who'd led the way to the invention of the top level of women's soccer. Had the game followed a fairy tale script, Michelle Akers would have scored the deciding goal on a screaming drive just under the crossbar from about 30 yards out. It didn't quite happen that way. Akers left the field at halftime with the game tied 0-0, but her former teammate in two World Cups and the 96 Olympics, Christine Lilly, banged home a goal in the second half to make Akers a winner one more time. As a determined and spectacularly successful athlete and an energetic and creative activist, Michelle Akers has served both the soccer community and the community at large consistently and well. Asked if, after a beautiful afternoon of practice and a gratifying final turn on the pitch, she would miss the game she'd played for so long, Michelle Akers wouldn't admit it. She has no time for looking back. She has so much else to do. The triathlon has become increasingly popular since several energetic lifeguards invented the combination swimming, cycling, and running competition 30 years ago. More than 500 kids and teens, some as young as 7, got a chance to compete at this grueling sport at the Iron Kids Triathlon National Championship early this month. This weekend, hundreds more will compete in the National Under-19 Championships. Only a Game's Michelle Seaton has this report.
This summer, 14-year-old Caitlin Ellis was the youngest participant to finish the Nantucket Iron Team's relay. Instead of competing as part of a team, she completed every leg on her own.
The first thing is a 2-mile run. This might not be exactly the distances. And then it goes into a 1-mile paddle. And then you do a 3.5-mile beach run with a 20-pound pack. And the swim, I think, is either a 1/2 mile, and then you do a 3/4-mile run to a 19-mile bike, and then a 6-mile run at the end.
Ellis finished the race in 4 hours, 19 minutes, and 54 seconds. She says she loves competing in grueling multi-sport races, although she admits that sometimes just having finished the race is the best part.
Well, sometimes during the race it's not as fun, but after you finish it, you're like, wow, that was really cool, because, like, afterwards, you think about it, it wasn't that bad, but during it, you're like, especially in like mile 12, like 11, or when you're almost near it, and you're like, when is it over? And then you have to run.
Ellis is part of a growing group of youngsters who are spending their summers training for and competing in triathlons. These junior races started a decade ago as a way for race directors to occupy the hundreds of kids who were dragged along to adult races by their parents. Now, junior triathlons are an international craze of their own. Last summer in New Zealand, kids' races routinely attracted more than 1,500 competitors. There are races for kids as young as 6 that feature much shorter distances, such as a 50-meter swim, 2 miles on the bike, and a 1/2-mile run. Older kids, such as 17-year-old Greg O'Donnell, are competing in adult events alongside their parents.
Some of my dad's friends, like, we're doing this triathlon around, and it seemed like fun, so I just went out and tried it. And I got into it, like, trying to compete with people, trying to pass these old guys on the road. It was fun.
At first, O'Donnell was using an old mountain bike for competition. Then he found an old touring bike that skipped gears. Now he has a $1,000 touring bike with toe clips, which should improve his times. After just one season, O'Donnell is hooked on triathlons. He plans to be competing for decades.
There's always more to do, you always improve. It's also a type of sport where you reach your peak when you're like 30 years old. So, and the guys that win my triathlon, the guy that wins every single week is like 45. So old people, it's like, takes a lot of maturing.
Swimmers ready, go!
Kids who do want to improve their skills can come to camps like this one, the Triathlon Dreams Development Camp, on campus at the University of New Hampshire in Durham. Here, young triathletes learn core skills such as improving their stroke. But they also learn how to take off a wetsuit quickly, how to pick up a dropped water bottle without getting off their bikes, and how to change a tire. But Steve Kelly is not just here to coach these skills. He's also a representative of USA Triathlon, which is a member organization of the U.S. Olympic Committee. Their mission is to identify future Olympians in this emerging sport.
We're running camps. We're running time trials. We look at results from races. We also look at swim races and running races, and we try to identify kids that have the right skill set for Olympic-style racing.
Likely candidates may be invited to 8-week residential camps at one of the Olympic training centers in New York or Colorado, where they can train with the pros. One such athlete is 17-year-old Mark Cody, who is a favorite at the Junior Nationals this weekend. He's exactly the kind of polite, outgoing overachiever the sport generally attracts. Triathlon has long been billed as an ideal sport for compulsive personalities. Cody says rather that triathletes must be passionate.
I've always had a passion for endurance sports. I never had the speed. I was never a sprinter in track. I was never a sprinter in swimming. And it's like, I was never the best swimmer, never the best runner. Cycling, I'm really starting to, you know, build up, and I'm doing all right against pretty good cyclists. But triathlon is the type of sport, if you can do every one of them all right, then it turns you into a great triathlete.
Cody admits that being just all right means running 5-minute miles, swimming 1,500 meters in under 19 minutes, and cycling at 25 miles per hour. Racing consistently at those speeds will put you into the elite class of junior triathletes. But Cody says it can also kick that compulsive streak into overdrive.
A lot of the juniors think, once they start getting to a national level, they think they have to be the best right away. So they start training, you know, 6 days a week swimming, 7 days a week biking, and, you know, 5 days a week running, or ridiculous hours. So, you know, they're putting in 40 hours a week training. So running 100 miles a week, your body isn't ready for it. To reach your peak shape, you need 4 or 5 years just to even get your body ready for something like this. It's not the same thing as going and running a 5K.
In the past couple of years, Cody has seen some of his best competitors burn out on this schedule and abruptly leave the sport at age 19 or 20. USA Triathlon, by contrast, wants kids to hang in there until they are 30 or 35, when endurance athletes typically turn in personal best times. In fact, USA Triathlon has shortened racing distances to keep kids from overtraining. Coach Steve Kelly.
For instance, if a child is under 15 years old or 16 years old, we pretty much limit them to a sprint distance triathlon, which is about a quarter mile swim, a 10-mile bike, and a 3-mile run.
Dr. Lyle McKaylee, director of the Division of Sports Medicine at Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, says that it's not the races, but the training regimen that can cause overuse injuries in kids and ultimately burnout.
But I think that on the face of it, triathloning has a lot to offer to a child, because it gives them three different kinds of skills they can then use for the rest of their life. But I would be very concerned to see the same kind of thing happened in triathloning that happened in a number of the other sports, where kids started running marathons under the age of 10, which clearly we feel is contraindicated.
Camp director Hope Troman says that it may be USA Triathlon's goal to create Olympians, but that's not her goal. In fact, she says, for kids who spend entire academic semesters in highly competitive sports such as swimming and track and field, where they may spend months shaving seconds off of lap times, running a couple of triathlons over the summer may be a relaxing alternative. 15-year-old Mary Casanguino seems to agree.
Yeah. When I'm not like a competitive summer, like trying to get my time slow, I'm just going to sit back and do the triathlons when I'm an adult.
For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Durham, New Hampshire.
You're listening to Only a Game. Thomas W. Davis, a Lexington, Virginia gentleman who characterizes himself as, quote, a devoted listener to Only a Game on station WMRA, wrote this week to chide me for, quote, the inadequate and disrespectful way you treated the story of Johnny Unitas's death. I took up the topic of Johnny Unitas's career with Charlie Pierce, but Mr. Davis felt we shortchanged his favorite quarterback and wrote, quote, that man's role in the history of the National Football League is second to none. William McAuliffe, who hears the show on WBUR here in Boston, likewise wrote to celebrate Unitas, the player he cited for, quote, remaining humble and a team player even after becoming a star. In the end, wrote Mr. McAuliffe, he not only won games and championships and set records, but as the true mark of greatness, he also fashioned new ways of playing the game, changing football forever. Joe Schmidt, who hears only a game on KWMU in St. Louis, was also unhappy with last week's program. Concerning my discussion with Tim Kirkchen of Baseball's Pennant Races, Mr. Schmidt wrote, "Congratulations, you provided a great review of the teams playing on the East and West Coast. Don't you think you and your baseball expert could recognize that some of the best baseball is played somewhere other than near an ocean? I know you're in Boston, but St. Louis has won the World Series at least a few more times than Boston and a little more recently as well, and I bet they win another one before Boston even gets close to playing in October." Yes, unhappily that's likely. Harsh, but likely. About the only comeback I could muster was an email reminding Mr. Schmidt that the Twins, whom Tim and I did discuss, don't play near an ocean. Finally, unhappily, Kevin P. Grace, who hears the show on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote to say, quote, "I have to get up early Saturday morning, and only a game helps me get going on the weekend. Keep up the great show." Your email will reach us at onlyagame@wbur.vu.edu, but it's more fun to go to the website, onlyagame.org, and get in touch with us that way. We live at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Harvard Athletics, celebrating its 129th year of intercollegiate football and 150 years of intercollegiate athletics. Season ticket information at athletics.harvard.edu. The Pine Hills, a new community off Exit 3 in Plymouth, featuring single-family homes, custom homes, townhouses, and condominiums, with championship golf and miles of walking trails. Online at pinehills.com. And Feynman Remodeling of Arlington, striving to create satisfied clients through innovations in architectural design, craft, and management. On the web at friremodel.com. Good morning, I'm Bob See, and in sports headlines, Nomar Garciaparra had two doubles and two RPIs to help the Red Sox beat the Orioles 4-2 last night in Baltimore. The two teams play again tonight. The Bruins also had a win last night, defeating the Washington Capitals 6-4 in Manchester, New Hampshire. The Boston College Eagles take on top-ranked Miami Hurricanes in Florida tonight. The Eagles haven't beaten the Hurricanes since 1984. And the New England Revolution will find out tonight whether they'll clinch a spot in the Major League playoffs when they take on the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars. Join host Michael Goldfarb this spring on the next Citizens of the World Tour to Vietnam and Cambodia. To learn more about this trip, call 800-909-9287. The weather forecast calling for partly sunny skies today, highs near 80. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the lower 60s. What if you had just $5 and had to spend it on something that would last an entire month? $5 might get you a child's ticket to a 90-minute movie or a few hours of long-distance service, but that same $5 can help bring you news and information on WBUR for an entire month. Take a moment to consider the value you get from listening every day. Then please respond to our letter in the mail by renewing your WBUR membership for just $5 a month. That's enough to help keep the news here for you every day of the year.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, evidence that the term fight of the century has finally been used accurately. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I would never have thought it, but perhaps first base coach needs to be added to coal miner, police officer, firefighter on the dangerous occupations list. I've seen refs and umpires insulted, even threatened, and that's dumb and reprehensible enough. But what do you make of the attack by father and son fans on Kansas City Royals coach Tom Gamboa during the game in Comiskey Park Thursday night.
Well, I think it's just another example of the pernicious effect of soccer on the American sports populace, and now starting to behave like rampant hooligans. It gives you a unique angle on all those wonderful intellectual treatises about fathers and sons enjoying baseball together.
Yes, indeed.
My father played catch with me in the backyard, and he walked me up the tunnel, and it was also very green, and we sat there, and there was music in the air, and people were laughing, and we decided to take off our shirts and get really drunk and beat the snot out of the first base coach. Baseball, America's pastime.
Yes, there it is. You can't call what's been going on between the Giants and the Dodgers a pennant race because they're fighting for a wild card spot rather than the pennant. Still, for those of us of a certain age, Giants against Dodgers late in September, that's been fun.
Now, that's interesting to me. Does that still carry, even though they've been both teams have been in California for 50 years?
Oh, absolutely.
See, I didn't know that.
Absolutely, yes.
I didn't know that. Yes, and I do think there's a real rivalry. We have another one of these semi-fake pennant races in the American League where the Angels and the Oakland Athletics are throwing the American League West back and forth. But there's a real stake there. One of those teams doesn't have to go play the Yankees in Yankee Stadium.
Absolutely.
There's a little bit less at stake, I believe, in the National League race.
Fans attending pro football games have always understood that a certain element of risk is involved. However, players used to think the risk to them was limited to action on the field, not, I gather, when the Eagles played in Washington, D.C. last week.
There was a altercation/brawl in the stands, and a police sergeant determined that it would be necessary to deploy the pepper spray. Unfortunately, as you know, one of the recent innovations in keeping football players cool in hot weather are these large fans.
Right, but right by the benches
well,
there.
Well, let me explain to our listeners who may have come in late what fans do. They suck air in from one place and disperse the air and anything that happens to be being carried by the air to another place. So the fans carried the pepper spray into the Eagles' bench. And I'll tell you what, the Philadelphia Eagles have never demonstrated the kind of lateral movement they showed then.
Yes, indeed. Now, several paragraphs into the account of the pepper spray story, we learn that the National Football League is investigating to see if there should be changes in methods of crowd control at games. I'm sure the D.C. police are eagerly awaiting the league's conclusions on this matter.
Well, I mean, I think the NFL sort of, you know, once you get the players involved, then the NFL has to sort of look into things. But they have no real power on how the local police departments do their job.
I hope they don't.
I mean, we are in the middle right now of a rather dangerous period, given everything that's happened, that police seem to be empowered to use just about anything at hand for about any other purposes. We saw, you know, the famous video of the grandmother being put in a chokehold at the anti-Bush demonstrations in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Without knowing more of the details here, I don't know whether this particular sergeant overreacted or not, but the NFL is going to have to watch this very carefully, because if police do feel empowered to overreact with whatever tools they have available, then there's going to be more of this.
In another remarkable National Football League story this week, the uniform rule was invoked to prevent Colts quarterback Peyton Manning from honoring former Colt quarterback Johnny Unitas in the way that Manning wished to do it. Why was that?
Because the NFL can. The NFL does things because the NFL can do it. What Peyton Manning should have done was just worn the shoes and explain why he wore them after the game.
For those who weren't paying attention, Manning wanted to wear black shoes, the kind that Johnny Unitas used to wear, even though the team is required to wear white shoes.
You know, here we have, we hear this endless maundering from sports writers about how athletes don't respect their sport, don't know the history of their sport. Here's probably the classiest young man to enter the NFL in the last 10 years, wanting to do something to show you how much he respects the history of the sport and the people who came before him, and the NFL has decided that he couldn't do it.
Right. Pro football lost another one of the game's greats this week, Charlie Bob Hayes, a star with the Dallas Cowboys and an Olympic gold medal winning sprinter as well, died. He was only 59. Lots of fans may be surprised to learn that Bob Hayes never made it to the Hall of Fame.
No, he didn't, and I sort of declined to view him as a football player because one of the earliest sports events that I really became involved in was the 1964 Olympics in Tokyo, where he won the gold medal in the 100 meters, but is most vividly remembered to me running the anchor leg of the 4x100 meter relay, which is still the most amazing sprint performance I've ever seen. It was hand-timed at 8.6. And if you saw it, you just saw a guy so far beyond everybody in the immediate competition
that you couldn't measure the distance he was beyond them. And that's the Bob Hayes I remember, the guy turning the corner with the baton in Tokyo.
Though the NFL season is only in its third week, I already have a candidate for comeback player of the year. How about Robert, they almost had to cut my leg off, Edwards, now of the Miami Dolphins?
That is not only comeback of the year, it's the greatest story in the NFL this year. Last year, I wrote a story about Robert Edwards' attempt. He was trying to come back at that point with the New England Patriots.
Right.
And I talked to every doctor who treated him, right down to the guy who was in the ambulance. He did everything to a human knee you can do. He was 20 minutes away from losing the lower part of his leg. The neurosurgeon who worked on him in the emergency room said he'd never seen an injury that bad, after which the person kept his leg. And it was a great moment. He said, "Why are you calling me now? What's the story?" And I said, "Robert Edwards is at training camp trying to make the Patriots." And the doctor said that was the greatest thing he ever heard.
Fans who regard athletes who haven't played on a championship team as failures and ne'er-do-wells have one fewer of that lot to disparage, Charlie. After 17 seasons in the National Basketball Association, Patrick Ewing has announced his retirement. He did it this week. Have you some favorite memories?
Well, I just remember when Patrick Ewing was a high schooler in the area around Boston. He played at Cambridge. And I just remember really awful things happening to him. I remember people throwing bananas at him. I remember guys in gorilla suits. And I remember that Mike Jarvis had him on sort of the Jackie Robinson leash that whole time.
Right.
And I don't know that Patrick ever really quite got over that. There's some talk that he's going to play for the Wizards. I hope he doesn't. I mean, he's on his way to the Hall of Fame. I hope he doesn't delay it by playing some stupid 15-game contract deal for the Wizards this year because he wants to play with Michael or something.
Finally, Charlie, I have learned of an intriguing golf tournament. It's at the Putra Golf Club in Kangar, Malaysia. The Raja of Perlis will be among the competitors, and the winner will earn 2 cows and a ton of rice. Interested?
I do love the organizing committee. It's organized by the Ex-Servicemen's Association of Malaysia. Now, doesn't that just give you a gin and tonics on the balcony of the Raj feeling, doesn't it, Bill? Hey, what?
Charlie.
What do you say we go to the game and beat the hell out of the coach? What?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and tees it up for Only a Game each week as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Tut, old boy, let's have a rubber.
In his recent book, entitled The Fight of the Century, Thomas Heidele writes of former heavyweight champion Jack Johnson, "Harlem's Black Hope became Brooklyn's Black Horror." Of the man who won his heavyweight title several decades later, Professor Heidele wrote, "Joe Louis epitomized the race diplomat." Thomas Heidele joins me now from the studios of WOI in Ames, Iowa. Professor Heidele, welcome to Only a Game.
Professor Littlefield, I'm grateful to be here for this opportunity to talk about my work and issues that I think should be of pressing importance to all Americans.
I share your opinion on that. The fight of the century is a common advertising claim for boxing promoters, but you had in mind a considerably more profound fight when you picked that title.
It would come as no surprise to my students that I've taught that it's a play on words in a way, and that you can do very serious historical material or any scholarly material more effectively with a sense of humor. The fight of the century, of course, could describe the Joe Louis Schmeling fight of 1938. It could define the Jack Johnson, Jim Jeffries battle of the century on July 4th of 1910 in Reno, Nevada. But I use the fight of the century in a much more encompassing term to suggest the American struggle with racism.
You write that when Jack Johnson won the heavyweight title in 1908, Southern legislatures, with the complicity of every branch of the federal government, had relegated blacks to a status not far removed from their previous subordination as slaves. That's a quote. To what extent was Jack Johnson aware of what it would mean to win the championship under those circumstances?
He varied in his impressions on that depending on when he was interviewed, in what stage of his career, and how the question was posed to him. I think I make clear in the book that Jack Johnson was no W.B. Du Bois or Ida B. Wells or Booker T. Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He was not terribly politically aware. He was aware, however, that to have any African-American at the top of his or her profession made a profound, even if subtle, statement about the capacity of all African-Americans. African American first, because of the rather peculiar nature of American race relations, have always been significant, especially significant for African Americans, but also significant for white Americans.
You found a lot of evidence in the black press that Jack Johnson dismayed many of those sports writers and others writing about him. One columnist warned that, quote, the lives, liberty, and happiness of over 9 million Negroes are being antagonized and jeopardized by his folly. This was a little bit later on in Johnson's career. Did Jack Johnson do more good than harm, ultimately, to the safety and to the status of black citizens?
I don't think any historian well-trained would answer that question with a straight yes or a no. I believe that initially in his career, he did a great deal of good. The symbolism of breaking barriers in Major League Baseball or in professional sports, I think, does have a resonance and a rippling effect, one would hope, in other areas of American society. But his own sense that he was going to live his life as an individual and he was not going to be dictated to or was not going to conform his personal behavior to the expectations of any group made it very, very difficult for better educated middle-class African-American editors and writers to see by 1913 or 1914 that he was a racial asset. So I would say that at the beginning, the consensus seems to be that he was a substantial asset to the race because of his symbolic importance. I think by the end of his career, he was seen as a rather unfortunate distraction. And I think that's important because I think it sets the stage for the way Joe Louis's managers promoted him, publicized him, and why Louis, mainly because of his character and the adept managing of his handlers, was able to break down some of the racial stereotypes and images and negativity about African Americans in the heavyweight boxing division and eventually won and made good in 1937 the quest for the title. And so he becomes the second African American heavyweight boxing champion and becomes defined in both the black mind and the white mind, I would say, as the antithesis of Jack Johnson.
Joe Louis was, of course, a different sort of champion, but perhaps his influence was even greater, as you're suggesting, than Jack Johnson's was. At one point, you ask a challenging question in the book. How does one ascertain the psychological and social impact of a black man repeatedly beating white men and making a fortune doing so within a nation whose senior members of Congress defended lynching? There is no short answer to that question, hence the book, I gather.
Louis, I think, is important for a number of reasons, but I think in large part, there's a remarkable migration of African Americans from the Deep South to the northern metropolitan areas and the far west. Between Johnson's rise to prominence and the emergence of Joe Louis in the second half of the 1930s. Louis, I think, becomes especially important, not so much, and I hope the book makes this clear, because of what he achieved in the boxing ring, which I think is admirable, but I think because of his behavior outside of it, especially in enlisting in the United States Army in World War II. And I think it's no coincidence if one looks ahead that Muhammad Ali during the Vietnam War was contrasted very unfavorably with Joe Louis because Joe Louis, of course, had put his own interests aside, the stories went, and had volunteered to serve in the United States Army during World War II. Muhammad Ali was branded as a draft dodger and, as you probably know, was stripped of his heavyweight title for refusing induction into the United States Army in 1967. And so the dynamic of the dynastic succession of champions and the way they deal with the social and cultural and political and military realities of their time proceeds all through the 20th century.
At the end of your book, you write, quote, the fight against race prejudice might well be the most difficult battle ever waged in American history. Against the odds, it can be won. What reflections of that struggle do you see in the current landscape of sports, if any?
I think for one thing, I point out, I think, in the closing chapter of the book that the argument against African Americans getting opportunity in Major League Baseball when the color barrier was in place was that they did not have the ability to play at that level. The National League pioneered the integration of Major League Baseball, and I'm not sure about this. Maybe a better baseball fan than I could attest to the truth of this. But I believe 16 out of the first 20 years that African Americans were in the National League, an African American baseball player won the Most Valuable Player Award. I believe fundamentally that racism is a learned behavior. And I don't mean to say that there are not prejudices or awarenesses of differences of people from different places or different cultures or of different pigmentation. But I ultimately believe that the kind of hardcore racism that I describe in the book is largely a matter of socialization. I don't believe it's innate. And I could not have spent the last 20 years of my professional life teaching the American West in history and legend and African-American history and cultural encounters and global history if I did not have some sense that those racist ideas developed largely to justify certain institutional and economic and political arrangements that were favorable to certain peoples and certain classes and unfavorable to other peoples and other classes. And I believe those things can be changed, and I believe we must change them.
Thomas R. Heidele is the author of The Fight of the Century, published by M.E. Sharp. Professor Heidele, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for this opportunity to talk about my work.
That's Joe the Bumper.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Peter Lawrence at WOI in Ames, Iowa. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or read more about the fight of the century, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, St. Louis Post-Dispatch columnist Brian Burwell expresses once more his gratitude at getting a shot on NPR and talking to its sophisticated listeners.
I'm used to the people who write me in crayon.
Now, don't let that give you any ideas, please. Email is working just fine. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
That he rates high. His girl Friday tells you why. He's Orchid's no stallion, sophistic battalion. That's Joe the Embalmer. Ah, he's a killer.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...